Comfort My People, Words of Encouragement and Hope. Hello, this is Doug Clark. Welcome to Probe. We sense with this week's Probe broadcast a change in the world, a sense of something new and refreshing in the book of Isaiah. No longer words of judgment and destruction, but now joy and celebration. Why this change? What has happened? To help us examine these questions, I've again asked Drs. Alden Thompson and Stravko Stefanovic, both of whom teach the Old Testament at Walla Walla College, to be my guests. Welcome to Probe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, as we think about the discussions, the published discussions, the articles, the books, maybe without end, about the authorship of Isaiah, we probably should stop and think about why people suggest more than one author, and if that's a problem, if we should be frightened by that idea. What is it that leads people to suggest that we might have a couple of a change even in authorship here between the first 39 chapters, although people have debates about parts of that, but between the first 39 and 40 and following?
Well, Doug, I think it might be helpful to back up first and ask the question, why devout believers are so frightened by that suggestion? Because as long as they're frightened by that suggestion, they won't consider it seriously. Mm-hmm. And what has happened, if you look back last 100, 200 years, critics began seeing things, and it's easier for critics to see things because they no longer believe in a personal God. So there's no threat of the Holy One who's going to pounce on them. There is instead this willingness to see everything. And there, for whatever reason, the tendency is saying, we have here a message from God, and he spoke through this particular person. And then people reject that for whatever reason, begin seeing things. And it feels to devout believers as if when you say, but Isaiah didn't write that, that they're saying it didn't really come from God. I think we have come far enough along now that we ought to say whatever we find in the Bible, from whomever, by whatever means, by whatever author, is there by God's design.
And part of inspiration.
Sure, absolutely. And the book of Jeremiah, another prophet one, is where you see that spelled out. You have Jeremiah, you have a secretary, and you have the Jeremiah estate, if you
want to call it. Chapter 36 in particular.
Sure. So all of those things are there. So I think it is not a wild and wicked idea to consider the possibility that parts of Isaiah may have come from a different time, different place, different person. Now, coming to your other question, what is it about it? And I'm going to pass that one over to my colleague here, Stravko, since I've talked way too long.
In chapter 39, Babylon is mentioned. And also, the words that Isaiah spoke to Zedekiah concerning the future tied to the supremacy of Babylon. And Hezekiah's somewhat self-centered words, there will be peace and security in my lifetime. Not really too much concern for the future. It is true that as we go now to this, if we can call it, second part of the book, that the context is no longer the Assyrian Empire, mm-hmm. but Babylon, mm-hmm. whether prophetically or out of the historical context and so on, as we have mentioned here. But we do have a switch of context, definitely.
We really do. And there are several verses that speak about shouting from Babylon when the captives are released. In fact, you have a reference at the end of chapter 44 to the fact that the Jerusalem Temple is no longer in existence, and that its foundations need to be laid. So I think you're right, Stravko, that you have two options. One is that Isaiah is carried in advance 150, 200 years, or that you've got another person in the spirit of Isaiah inspired. That's not the big issue. Whichever way you go there, we do have a shift. There's a sense that we've now come to kind of sit among the exiles in Babylon and then sense the potential for joy and release.
Well, you have here also a sense of a monumental disaster which is being turned around. You take right at the beginning of chapter 4, comfort, O comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that she has served her term, that her penalty is paid, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. Now, see, that doesn't fit in the Assyrian crisis, because the Assyrians went back home with their tail between their legs. But Babylon really did cart them off. So it speaks of coming out of a great tragedy, and now God says, I want to comfort you.
That's interesting to me, too, in the very last words that you read, Alden, that Israel has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. If you read some of the Psalms from the time of the exile, 44, 74, they speak about what seems to be overkill. Yes, we've sinned, but wow, this much, this hard. And here there is the reference to they did get it pretty hard. I'm just struck by that. I don't know exactly what it means.
And in addressing the oppressor, the prophets of the Old Testament did say that they went too far in expressing their anger and their violence and so on, and there are words of threats that they will be punished for that, including Babylon.
Right. A change, if in fact we think about 40 and what's new in chapter 40, to what some people have said, almost unbridled joy. Mm-hmm. Comfort, joy, prepare the way for a return, celebrate under God the deliverance, even though the grass withers, the word of God is there. God has promised, has pledged this return. We can have our hope in that because it's God and not us who's made these words, who's made these promises. Then the chapter bursts forth in a creation hymn. Beginning with verse 12, I think it is, that we have the lines about creation. Where do we go? Where does this go from here? Before you get at the answer, I need to tell you that one of the most memorable times I've read chapter 40 of Isaiah was in Petra in Jordan. The first time I went there, a full moon, it was late at night. We were going to sleep inside that first carved facade there and the building there, the treasury. And we read for our devotional on Friday evening by the light of the full moon, 11:30 at night, Isaiah 40. It was so moving, this creative, powerful God. What do we have here?
Will you allow me to describe this as something like a fiesta in the wilderness? You said, here people burst in joy because of what God is doing for them, God who is coming to his people. And we find Zion and Jerusalem being summoned as witnesses to go to the other cities of Judah, spread the good news. And then the answer is given why God is doing all of this. Because he is the Creator God. He's different from all the others. And this is another distinctive characteristic of the second half of the book, where God constantly challenges others. Who can compare to me? Who can do this? Who can do that? And in the first place, that is that God is unique because he is the creator of the earth.
Right, right. What kind of language do we have? Following up on those questions, you're exactly right. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and so on?
There's a lot of wisdom here, isn't there? On the one hand, it is good poetry. It's a hymn of praise. I do not know exactly what my answer should be, but at least I see these two genres.
Now, we have language of creation in lots of places in the Old Testament. Often, it seems to me, in the context of song, of hymns, of celebration put to poetry, to music. And it seems to me that that's what we have here, with remarkable images. I mean, if you just look at the first part, in verse 12, measured the waters in the hollow of his hand. I mean, okay, God can put an ocean over here on this hand and another ocean over here. Mm-hmm. Who has marked off the heavens with a span. Well, let's take a hand span between this constellation and that one. That's the kind of God we serve. Mm-hmm. Who takes mountains Now, maybe the Bible writers didn't know about Mount Rainier or Mount Everest or Mount St. Helens. Well, St. Helens isn't nearly what it used to be, but, you know, to weigh mountains on a scale that God holds in his hand. This is such a remarkable picture. Mm-hmm. What are we supposed to feel? Maybe this isn't just for information. Maybe this is also to give us a feeling.
It serves a definite purpose. Verse 27, okay, because of all of this, why do you say, O Jacob, and complain, O Israel, my ways hidden from the Lord, my cause is disregarded by my God? So that all-powerful God is the same God who knows the problems of the people, of his people, of the individuals, and so on. It's a powerful a spiritual lesson here.
It is. And I want to come to those last verses right after the one you quoted in just a minute. Let me ask, though, about some more of this imagery. What kind of imagery do we have in this celebration of God as the Creator? Now, to answer my own question, thank you, Alden, for giving me permission to do that, knowing that I was excited about that idea and that question. There's a host of them here, but one of them is creating the world like a Bedouin tent host would stretch out his tent, stretching out a tent like the heavens in verse 22. Which is, I think, would connote at least to the ancients that, okay, this is a place where we can go and we can be protected. We will be welcomed there. We'll have food. That's how God intended to create the world, just from the use of this imagery. I don't know, other ideas that come from this psalm.
Well, you have the beginning of the mockery, which this last half of Isaiah is so common, where you say these marvelous things about this huge and magnificent God, and then what will you compare him with? Verse 19, an idol? You know, somebody that carves around and overlays him with gold and so on. What do you think this is?
The prophets can't quite get away from that, can they?
No, they can't. Mm. And then you have this marvelous conclusion, the one that, and I do think we ought to take a look, because it's a very precious message to me. You have these skeptical questions, the ones that Stravko raised. You know, why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel? But then you come down to the answer, have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. We could say, even though he's been carting around these mountains, one on the other side, he doesn't faint or grow weary. He gives power to the faint and strengthens the powerless. Even youths will faint and be weary, and the young will fall exhausted. But those who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint.
What makes these words very meaningful is God is everlasting, he's powerful, he's creator. But that's not all. Those who hope in him, they can benefit of that renewed strength.
And would this mean something especially to people who felt all hope was gone?
And if they imagine the trip back, that long road, they shall run and not be weary, they shall walk and not faint.
And that whole sense that here is the Creator, but it doesn't end there. It's not just a description of the Creator. It's the reason that has hope for us and meaning today. Mm-hmm. Well, to conclude, are there words anywhere else in the Bible as hopeful and encouraging, as uplifting and majestic, as transcendent and yet still imminent for people's lives, as heavenly and yet so tied to our earthly needs? Thank you, Alden and Stravko, for your help today. Next week on Probe, Alden and Stravko will again be my guests as we continue talking about Isaiah, this time the first of the so-called Servant Songs, chapters 42 and 49. My thanks to Steve Cochran, the producer of Probe, and to all of you for listening in. At Probe, I'm Doug Clark.
You've been listening to Probe, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla College and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you may call 509-527-2194 or email probe@wwc.edu. Join us again next week at the same time for Probe.